Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about a makeover of the school experiment. This is the basic experiment that you might do in class, where the teacher says, roll up your page, write experiment, and you know the basic parts to fill in. Write the word aim, underline it, do an aim, hypothesis, go through all of that sort of thing. So this is going to be a alternative to it. Some may say it's innovative. However, from the perspective of a scientist looking in, it's sort of like someone who, I suppose, doesn't fertilize their garden or parks over their cat or something like that. It's done. It's done fairly, I suppose, poorly, but it's the way it's always been done. So, you want to do it a different way. That's by necessarily innovation. However, it's not really innovation. I'm breathing a little bit because I've got to walk up this hill while I'm podcasting. I'll give you a bit of a background story to it. But it's not really so much innovative. It's just a witness of the way we scientists do things, and a lot of us don't actually stand back from what you're doing to say, why am I doing it? Why? How is that done? What does it sound like this particular way? And it's really come from me reading reviews of scientific studies. Sociologists have actually gone in depth and discussed, you know, what are scientists doing? And surprise, surprise, they're not doing what their teachers have been teaching in school. So they're doing something slightly different, slightly a bit more expansive, and slightly a bit more meaningful, and slightly a bit more productive than what's going on. Now, that's not... They're teaching the wrong thing. It's not a sort of an anger about it. It's just, this is what's happening. You're teaching something different, and that's correct within a sort of a universe of schools. Now, this is not the first time this sort of thing has happened. In terms of Descartes, who ran Descartes in the 1600s, a French scholar, famous for Cartesian coordinates, famous philosopher on the theory of mind. When he looked at back, and he loved his school, and he thought his Jesuit training was fantastic, it was great, but he said when it came to actually teaching reason, the actual mechanics of what was going on, it was too old schools to teach a parody of reason. Now, I wouldn't say what's taught at school is necessary, it is sort of like a parody, it's sort of like a play of science, and scientists do it slightly differently and slightly more expansively and a slightly different way, because that's what they do. They're not doing it a different way to make the schools look foolish or to make them angry or upset. It's just that's the way it is. There's been a prediction in a school environment. So a school environment has the thing of you tend to teach the way you've been taught, and you teach students to pass an exam that you would have sat. And so schools tend to preserve a way of doing things, much like any culture preserves a way of doing things. So when you go to Germany and you want to see this cultural display, you don't want people wearing the most modern things, the most comfortable things. You want to get them wearing the, I think it's Lederhosen, the little hats with a little brush up the top, and the big blouses and that type of stuff. You want to see them doing that. You want to preserve. So cultural institutions have a tendency to preserve what they're doing, and you might call it coercion, but it's gentle, it's steering people to actually do what's been done before. And so this is just to set you in the right sort of mental framework to listening to this, it is different. It is a witness to what scientists actually do, and it is different from what schools teach. And what schools teach is they teach a thing which reproduces what's been taught previously, and actually students can get marked, and it's sort of like a currency, a cultural currency, and it's very good at preserving things, and it's an amazing thing that these ideas can be preserved and passed on, even though they've outlived their usefulness, and even though nutritionally, they don't provide any nutrition. So if I can give you a food analogy, in the 60s and into the 70s, Australian cuisine was three meats and a veggie, not quite, but what would happen is we'd get the vegetables and we'd boil them, and we would add salt and butter to everything. So if you had peas, they'd be boiled really until they're completely gone in salty water, and then you would add butter. You wouldn't have a potato, you'd always add butter to potato. And so the basic things are there, peas, carrots and stuff like that, but they've been treated such the actual nutritional value has been reduced. And why did everyone do it? Because it was a culture, and it took a while for new culture to come in. Now, I suppose you'll ask the question, well, I'm not about to set up a shingle, as it says, or change what's done. Look, I'm just walking past, and there's 1, 2, 3, there's 13, oh, no, dare I say, 13, there's actually 15, self-crested cockatoos. You always have, with the cockatoos, you always have a guard bird up the top. So you often, in this case, it's always one guard bird at the top watching over the flock. Okay, getting back to it. So the idea is that we're not criticizing things. You can continue teaching things the way that you want to. However, if you ask the scientists, and you really push them, they'll say, well, no, in actual fact, we don't do any of that. And the end course result of what they're doing is that the parody of science experiments, which are taught, won't really work for the person, because it doesn't work for scientists in the field. It actually doesn't work for students as well. You're creating a extension, a task with certain tick boxes that students can fail on. So it's not just a benign thing of saying, doing it, it's not going to hurt. The more you ask, the more opportunities there are to fail. So if I can say, what is an ideal science experiment? The heading is nice and clear, label right and clear, title of it, things underlined, neat writing, a neat scientific diagram, a table, everything following it, everything going through the actual structure. So if, say someone left out the word conclusion, they'd lose marks. Oh, how do I know this? Well, because there's rubrics. You get so many marks for doing so much, and it's nice and cleared, but there is a way that you can mark a scientific report. And what I'm saying is that that rubric is just a method that someone can lose marks and embodies, say, a poor understanding of what scientific studies are. So, though the rubric sets the standard, it's nice and clear, but it also embodies what people are doing incorrectly. I suppose they are incorrectly, and there's a massive point where the scientific experiment is co-opted for an educational goal. They're actually educating by science, which it's an experiment, and this is true. What the fundamental idea of an experiment is that an experiment is nature educates you, but it's not the explicit sort of education you get in school. It's more of, if nature doesn't do it, nature doesn't want to do it. Nature is actually inert, it's our construct, but the reality coming in, if it doesn't actually fit it, it says to various degrees, no. So nature never says yes outright, wackadoodle, yes, it's a big tick. It says, from what it says, you can interpret it as saying no, or maybe no, or unlikely. So, that's the whole disproving the hypothesis aspect of it, but there's more danger in it. So let's go through at this stage before I get your brain completely fried with a new way, quote, innovative way, or not running over your cat way, if you consider it a way of parking knowledge. And they tend to sort of park knowledge, you know, with the driver instructor there all the time, and things get destroyed and you get disheartened because it's set up in a way that you can actually fail. G'day. So I'm just using this to walk through. So let's look at the standard way. So if you said to a secondary school teacher in Australia, it's got to be ruled up. Well, might even answer that, but they say, look, I need a title, then I need an aim. What is the experiment about? And then I need a hypothesis. Then depends, they might want apparatus. Now there's a difference between, I should have pointed out, even this stage, even the crazy sort of spectrum-y parody of a science lesson, very few scientists or very few teachers know the difference between equipment and an apparatus. So I'll just at this point go forward and tell you the difference. So your tent, you're camping in a tent, got all the poles and pegs and everything's wrapped up, and that's your camping equipment. But the apparatus is something that actually does something. So it's your assembled tent. So the apparatus, so you have an equipment list, which you pull out there, and then you have it drawn up as an apparatus. So the equipment, so a lot of people don't know the difference. So equipment would be three test tubes, a Bunsen burner, piece of pipe, matches, stuff like that, and it could be all in a drawer. That would be the equipment for the experiment. But when it's all put up, ready to go, and you can actually see how the equipment fits together, that's the apparatus on the list. And then people have a method. Now, the method, is not really well understood. It's sort of like a method. People think of it as a lineal. It tends to get written into books as a method / procedure. Now, a method / procedure is a sequence of steps that you follow that someone else could naturally follow. And it's steps. So in general, they're like, they're in a series of steps, so you can go back and refer to a particular step number 2 and 3, or repeat number 4, go off if that to allow it to go halfway to a flow diagram. And there's a sort of, because you're doing a parody of it, people don't know between where the purpose of what you're trying to say and how you say. So I know this in rubrics. People wanted a numbered sequence which would be read out to someone who someone could follow. However, if the procedure is a standardized procedure. You can refer to that as a subroutine procedure that someone would go through. But the entire idea of being able to number it and go through a into a flowchart really is a more global idea of numbering and cross-referencing what you've just written. So this is an advanced science technique, which is neither innovative nor advanced. Well, it is innovative in advance because teachers generally get the way they've been taught by the way they've been taught, and by people who get a gig explaining how things are done. So if you're a disliked teacher, or if you're a teacher on the out of the system that for various political reasons you want to push off to the side, you'll never hear it. However, in the real world, there's a sequence of doing diagrams, procedures of this referencing thing. So, and it really is something which is encapsulated from my experience doing patterns, doing pattern diagrams. So, let's talk about, and from mechanical engineering, I've been taught to do things. So, basically, as a scientist in the field, you go out, you have to do a diagram for a machinist. So, you're there, you have to do a diagram for a machinist to get a job done in a period of time. So in order to get a job done in a period of time, you have to learn project management. So you go to a book, read project management, read up Gantt charts. Pretty simple, sort of half an hour going through, you read up Gantt charts, and in order to get the equipment built by a certain date, you have to learn how to mechanically draw. How to do it? How do you do it in 1 or 2 weeks? I was verbalizing the way that I went through it. And I phoned up, I still remember, Andrea Bunting, Mechanical Engineering, and said, what's the deal? I'm a PhD student, I need to produce something within a certain period of time. So eventually, I got my PhD done, dusted in 2 years flat. But this is just applying basic technique. And if you wind back the clock a bit, been trained in different areas, army and various things like this, how to get the job, how to get the show on the road by a certain amount of time. You've got to get so much equipment, so many people, to good grid coordinate, such and such on such and such a time, just do a plan, just must attack through it. So, we're at the point of where we're actually teaching someone to do a diagram and stuff like that. So, initially, when you first do it, it's a bit rubbishy, and people come around and critique it, or you've been doing it some ways, and you, a few years later, get involved in, oh no, you've, in my case, I've always been involved in patents, but you go in the patent, and you see how things are done. And in terms of your basic literacy, yeah, the fundamental aspect, the real core of it, is that teachers are literate in the politics of schools and education department. They're not literate in the actual finer, deeper detail of science, and this is what we're doing at this stage. So, if we just pan out, you know, I still almost see it like a dimensions here. I can see a dimension of my spirit, my experience going through to teaching, and at the teaching thing I go backwards to experience, try and explain it. But we've got the aim hypothesis, which is just appalling, and I'll explain why it's appalling later on. Your method apparatus and all that gig to say how you do it. And the important point is that I want to bring in a few how-tos at this stage. One is, when you're drawing something, you draw it in very light pencil. You can barely see it. And as it's structured right, you get it right. And then you draw the actual apparatus or what you're doing in heavier pencil. So this is hand, you can do this digitally pretty much the same way, or say chem draw. Oh, there's all these drawing programs which you can just pick up and plot on. It's all pretty straightforward. But this is the hand earthy way, and you draw it very lightly, and you might freehand draw a circle, or you might freehand draw it, and then what you do is you then go over, and it's the basic rule is two-dimensional, minimum number of lines, and there's certain requirements, like for a test tube you don't put anything which has got a line on the top of it is closed, so a test tube doesn't have the line at the top, it's just a single line down, curve and up. So that's done lightly in pencil, and after you've got it generally sketched, you do it properly, you go over it with a ruler. Now, one of the things you can do is run the ruler left to right down the page. Now, there's a secret trick. Now, I've lost these things. They break up. But you can actually buy these rulers with little rollers in them. So as you roll them down, they don't twist from side to side. It's just a small thing. They're not a huge ruler. They're just a small thing. They've got this bizarre roller lookup table on the inside. Just insane. I think it's Staedtler. And you can rule it down. Now, these people say, how you label diagrams. Now, this is another example of school guff going along, that the label diagrams must always be with straight pencils, and it must or must not touch the test tube. So your labeling thing must be horizontal. This is all wrong. Okay. And it produces a diagram which is basically unreadable, but gets you maximum rubric marks. They say, are the lines straight? Blah, blah, blah. All this type of stuff. Gives you maximum rubric marks. You can't actually force someone to do this. But it's completely wrong. This is essentially what I want to say here. So it's completely wrong. So in general, if you look at a pattern diagram, something is marked not with a straight line, but with a splined line, which sort of goes down a hill and flat. So, and they're lettered, and the reason that they're lettered is from old microfilm days, that you wanted to be able to get a diagram and shrink it. And so if you've got text, you can't read the text if it's being shrunk, but you can read letter A, B, C. But the end result is that you then put a legend A, B, C, D. So the test tube would be A, the thermometer would be T, for instance, or T1 for two thermometers and stuff like that. And you just have a legend, which is A, B, C, D, all your different letters as you go across. And of course you don't have to necessarily, if you're using the symbol for a test tube, right, you don't have to say it's a test tube. Alright, if you're doing the symbol for a heat source, which is in this case a Bunsen burner, which a symbol for heat source is or either a triangle or a simple thing is a upside down thumbtack, theoretically you don't have to label it because that's what that symbol means. Sort of like label the letter A. A, B. B is A. It's all gone mad. Now, you then do your method. You then do the results. And again, there's a Australian standard which is developed to record results the most efficient way. And indeed, that makes one weep week for several reasons. One is that the people are obsessed, besides teaching them the incorrect way to do diagrams, they're teaching them the incorrect way to do tables. And they say the major thing of a table is it must be enclosed on all sides. Why? G'day. Why? No reason. There's actually no reason. If you look in scientific literature, it's the minimum number of lines to the maximum amount of readability. However, the legend has it that in an HSC, one examination table thumped it and said, I'm going to remove one mark from every person in the state who didn't do their table in a square. That got going across, and that has much more effect than someone saying, look at the style guides for all the scientific journals. Look at all this modern science. Look at everything. Tables no longer have to be in a square or, there are various listing, but that's another example. I suppose I'll do another podcast on the Australian Standard Lab Book. When I say the Australian Standard Lab Book, what happened is that I developed and trained various people, and I found out this particular method of drawing up when I visited a company overseas. They were using exactly my technique, and they said, and they told me all about this new Australian standard, which was essentially the series of techniques that I had used for, they picked up the best from the Russians and the Japanese. The Japanese have beautiful paper folding skills. It's amazing. And the Russians have got very good time, or the Russian scientists I have involved were very good at recording times and satellite information, which allowed you to go across. And then there's a bit of programming skills in terms of that there are symbols that you put on the page which tell the reader what you're doing without too much. This is for data. So you've got your method, your results, your discussion, your conclusion, and you write all that. And theoretically, depending on the whim of the teacher, the student can get very high marks by replicating a certain neatness in writing. Unfortunately, what they do is a parody, is not what scientists actually do. So very rarely when a scientist is doing a experiment in their lab book for CSIRO or a research center of excellence, do they get a lab book and rule it up and say, aim, blah, blah, blah. And we know this because, I didn't do it. Another scientist internationally observed didn't do it. But moreover, sociologists who came in and sat in and wrote books about the big science efforts in the gravity waves and CERN. There's been sociologists writing books, and we know that they don't do it there either. So we've got this bizarre thing of taught a very strict, regimented way, which is not actually thought through, which is just more knee-jerk reactions to people winning political fights at various points in time. It's sort of like a political compromise. And really it's a cultural reenactment of a thing that produces some obvious structures which basically a simple person could mark. You know, the table, it's not in a square. The diagram, well, I actually don't know how a diagram does, but this is the way that they get maximum marks if they draw with, you know, direct labels written out in full, and they label, you know, really obvious things like I've forgotten what they're called. She was, I'm suffering from mental reset. Oh, a tripod. That's called a tripod for some reason. You draw a tripod with the correct symbol for a tripod, and then you say, that's a tripod. And the reason you do that is because someone will give you an extra mark for it. It's great. And it means that you have spent time not thinking about your experiment, doing that, that overall thing. So the thing is, I've really built up, and it should remind at least Australian teachers, you know, what, how we teach our science students to write up, experiments. And, what I'm saying is that, there's a core of, or let's look at the fundamental aspects of it. And it's not fundamental aspects. These are not really obvious to everyone. I've waded through a 4-inch thick book on gravity waves before it came to the end, where they it was recapitulated, restated, and so gravity waves is the ultimate story. That's looking for the faintest paint pattern. It's basically a sophisticated eavesdropping device. These are microphones. In fact, if you were to speak too loudly by a gravity wave machine, it would pick your voice out, and it would go as all these black holes crashing. So there's a number of cases where you had to be very, very quiet. It looks for vibrations. Seismograph works for vibration. I must admit, the technicians, there's this beautiful technician in Adelaide University, very quiet, very gentle person, and he was the technician who built the seismograph station, put it all up there, and he was very quiet. When he put down a pen, it wouldn't slam down any pen, he would put down it quietly. He was a vibration-proof technician, because he's used to working on seismographs. And essentially, we're looking for space quakes there. And all this theory, it's not obvious to each other. It's what comes across. And then, could this way that we actually work cooperatively in large scale and advance our scientific understanding, could it be translated down to the classroom? Now, the answer is, well, to use an Australian saying, blood oath, mate, it's sure as eggs. Sure as eggs can be done. So let's go through the story. So we put school beside us. I had a bit of a rant and a rave. I have to rant and rave to fill up my podcast while I'm walking to my blood tests at this point in time. So we've had a rant and rave. I've had a tilt at diagrams, not much good. Education has got a knack of setting hurdles that are easy, but if you fall, people get dissuaded and nothing has really been achieved. No knowledge, no deep understanding. All you've done is you've weeded people out. Good on you. Sort of like having a birthday party, and the first game you humiliate people, and so they hate the birthday party. So eventually you get three or four people who finally are happy at the birthday party, and then what you do is you hold a ceremony for them. These people have successfully had the birthday party. That type of thing has happened. So we've gone through there, and I've given you a story that real scientists and real groups of scientists. I was checking I'm on the right path here. Real groups of scientists do it differently, and we don't do it differently to make teachers and schools look foolish. Whatever they're doing it by themselves. They're not asking us anything about it. And they're giving you the idea that just the basic two things is that the most fundamental thing, there's patterns and significance. And there's a real battle. You know, there's a pattern from outer space, and what is significant? And of course, gravity waves is the extreme, because it requires massive computing, massive social systems before we can say, blood oath, it's a neutron star. Quick, we've now the Italians, that's what we call them, Italians, I've got it. You can actually, we've got the three microphones, we can actually pick up where the sound has gone from. It looks like you've got, you got two ears, that's a Coltrane going over the top. You've got two ears, so you can tell where left or right things are. The two ears doesn't necessarily mean you can tilt up or down. If you tilt your head, you can tell up or down or get some information. But with three ears, it's a three-eared microphone, and they can quick. We can now see a gravity wave, go in and pick up the light from it. It's all box and die. But going up there, there's the people on this very cusp of significance are saying, I think this is significant. And there's some honest errors that they can make. This is the really cool Western Australian group had this huge three-time massive super-controlled niobium cylinder. And they would be listening to it. They would be listening for sound waves in the cylinder in Western Australia. And these people were the coolest, nicest people. And not only could they hear one gravity wave, there were thousands of gravity waves. And of course, they honestly believed it. And part of the Nomate, you call that a gravity wave machine. This is a gravity wave machine, which is the LIGO, the 3 kilometer laser. Being that, what is the space one? It's going to be a corker. That will be fantastic coming through. But they were looking at patterns, attributing significance of it, and at the very edge, honest procedure. And this is what kids do. They see patterns, they attribute significance of it. There's all these reasons that they attribute significance. They will attribute significance to please someone else, or because it fits in with the fantasy world. And they will have a web of, a basket of significance. And it's a precious thing. What they find significance is the most precious thing that a kid can bring into a classroom. It's not, they can bring understanding skills and stuff, but that basket of significance is you're trying to actually interact with that basket of significance where they get to love what they find significant, feel secure with it, and feel confident to just rearrange the significance, not throw away their belief in Noddy and Thomas the Tank, put that to a side. That doesn't necessarily have to be chucked out. It can be just pushed aside. And the significance that they bring into the classroom has to be respected and moved around the place. So this is patterns and significance. So let's do it. Let's think of something which speaks to patterns and significance. So here's the new look. Whatever it is, science thing. Right, your AIM hypothesis. I'll have a rant about hypothesis because people tend to put a hypothesis proves a theory. End of it. In fact, people give them extra marks by justifying their hypothesis for the theory. They put the because. And the reason is that then if the experiment is successful, they have got the reason, which is just insane step backwards, punching someone back into the Stone Age by doing that. So here are the limits, and obviously I've been coming back from brain insult and stuff like that, so I've remembered things. I've had to codify it. 4 P's. Preamble. G'day mate, I'm coming up to measure your meter. Seems a problem with your car. It's steaming. Preamble. You're travelling in the Nullarbor Plains and you're stuck. Preamble. Pattern is, you know, that cloud formation, or that has a pattern. for it. Now, you've got to go a bit further. You have to have a path, which is equivalent to your method apparatus, the path that you have gone to get a picture of the pattern that you think might be there. Okay? So it's preamble, pattern, path, picture, and then the significances, numerical significance. That is the data reliable, or have you actually, this is in your discussion, the evidential significance, is the camera pointing at the right direction, is the lens cap off, is what's this evidence. So all your photographs can turn out black, and you can conclude it's night, and get great evidence, but great numerical support for the evidence. And then there's social significance, given your significance framework, and the framework of your mates, what does this tell you? So you got your overall significance, and you can discuss if you want to. There's no law about not writing anything. And so that's four P's, three S's. Then here's the company where you have a tilted proper education. You get them to generate a multiple choice in lieu of an in-depth review discussion. And that is, from this evidence, what can you conclude? What's a good multiple choice? And these are three things which you can't and one thing that can be as a good thing. And the multiple choice may be bad or good, but it's not the actual quality of the multiple choice, it's actually the effort put into it. So you've got multiple choice. Then you have the answer. So really, I'll start off again. You then have the answer. What have you learnt? What was the story? And then subsequent follow-on questions to do the next experiments or to do deeper experiments and stuff like that. Now, something I left off is at the very start, you start off with a question. Say you're in a level plane. How did you get here? You're on your two-way radio, mate, I'm stuck on an audible plane. Okay, you give a bit of a preamble, and then they start to, travelling. I'm inexperienced, I'm a tourist, I'm out here, a bit of preamble that's going on. And then pattern across like this. Now this actually goes smoothly at scale. In terms of the ability for this to move, you can hear these Aussies, international listeners, can you hear that? That's audio light. And it's also a tactile light that actually goes beep. So if you can't hear, typically if you can't hear, which is sort of almost as dangerous. You can go across there. And so I'm crossing up across for my blood test. Hopefully with this activity in my veins will be okay. It's absolutely ripping cold. It's about 14 degrees at the moment, so it's freezing. So what this is sort of a really earthy thing, a pattern and significance, and you're discussing already a very high level with the student why is this significant. In essence, it requires a very gentle approach. What do you find fascinating with it? You really need to be, almost before you introduce it, to actually raise up their own experience and their own fascination with it. Before they go, come on. Now there's a car with a... There we go. You've got to get your own... it's all a very personal experience, because at the end of the day, by the time I do 36 experiments, or whatever your class size is, and they all measure the temperature of boiling water, you haven't actually really advanced our understanding, the nation's understanding of boiling water, all that much. But But the real aim of an experiment is to grow the knowledge. But even then, the aim of the knowledge is not there, it's to build the attitude and resilience of your student, so that they're confident they can do the experiment, confident they can get the most out of the experiment. And at the end of it, if you test, do a end of year test and say, what is the temperature of boiling water? 100 degrees C. Right? Well, and then you're there as a person, you say, as a teacher, you're in there, you're saying, this is a good test. What if it's the pressure is wrong? Oh, don't worry, we haven't taught them that. What else are we going to test them? We can't possibly ask another question about it, which is sort of like the measurement technique. Now, if the student was actually off learning at the time, they may have picked up major things, missed that minor point. And of course, once you have embedded the top students with the belief that all water boils at 100 degrees, you then actually add some more information, more complexity to it, where they have to actually unlearn it. So when you actually look at it, the amount of stuff that we teach and how valuable it is and what it actually does teach, it teaches up the worst comes to worst is that a student goes through the entire education system and doesn't do all that well, unfortunately. This is the reality of it. Doesn't do all that well. And they get the lowest ATAR score, which is the Australian University Entrance Score. And the only thing they can do is teaching. So teaching has the lowest ATAR score of anything. And of course the government's going to change that by legislating that you can't be a teacher if you've got a low ATAR score. And the only experience they've had is being taught in a particular method, replication method, which generates academic results. And of course, they've come through a system which poo-poos doing things any other way, or a sophisticated way. So what's going to be the result? Because I'm coming to the end now. The result is perhaps nothing. Perhaps one country, one group of people will start following the line of look up and say, get an interest in gravity waves, get an interest in CERN or the modern science going along, and move across. They might do it. I can tell you a better way to teach, but I can't tell you the actual political, social levers that would pull to make everything done. And in fact, it really doesn't interest me. It really doesn't interest me, the celebration of being the most, having the most respected high quality stuff. That's almost the poison which is actually keeping us back. The search for high quality standard hours way of doing things, when it really doesn't matter all that much. That indeed is the poison that's holding us back. Thanks a lot for listening. I'll be going off for my blood test now. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.